items, matters that are important for them and for us to consider as we approach Election Day. Last week, Leah Berger shared her thoughts, and this week I've asked Jim to do the same. Jim?
Oh, thank you, Arnold. Actually, I should start with an apology. Michelle Obama wanted to be here. She couldn't make it. So she asked me to come instead. I hope you don't mind. John Adams famously wrote at the end of the 18th century the following: "Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There has never been a democracy that did not commit suicide." Now, what brings this quote to mind is not so much the tawdry, racist, misogynistic language of this campaign, but it's the squandered opportunity to talk about real issues that affect people's lives, that has been taken away from us. Even when real issues came up, sexual harassment, immigration, global warming, there was never enough time to talk about them, never enough time to move ahead on these issues. So the inane discussions and name-calling that have characterized this campaign aren't simply a function of polarizing candidates dropping out of nowhere. I believe that this has come from decades and years of trends in American politics that are very worrisome and very scary. So how did this happen? We have at least two polarizing political parties in this country that are driven by extreme elements on both the right and the left, fueled, in addition, by special interest money that has come into our campaigns that have further shaped the dialogue and discussion. The result is that our parties are blind to the problems of real people, blind to the issues that affect people's lives, the economic inequality that occurs in this, that is, exists in this country, and that has tarnished the American dream for most people. And the result is that our constituents are angry and frustrated, and many people would just as soon blow up the whole system, or worse, bury their heads in the sand. We've elected people to government who've forgotten how to govern and forgotten that basically the role of elected officials is to govern. And to govern, you have to be able to negotiate, and you have to be able to compromise and accommodate and listen to what other people have to say. We've neglected education in fundamental ways. Civic literacy in this country is appalling. 3 out of 5 American people can't identify the 3 branches of government. I just read a survey that shows that 50% of American voters believe that the president can unilaterally change the Constitution. Not only is civic literacy at risk, but critical thinking skills in our population are at risk as well. People can't discern fact from fiction. We haven't taught kids, I think, as well as we should, about how to do critical thinking. We demonize people in government who are our servants carrying out our will are demonized as losers, as people who can't make it in the real world, and that's why they take these cushy jobs in government. And information and facts, which are the lifeblood of democracy, are fed to us through media channels that spew highly tailored information in highly tailored ways, so we actually only have to listen to people that we already believe. We aren't actually exposed to a broad range of opinions and facts. So we need to realize, when all is said and done, when this election is over, that somebody is going to have to govern, and that is going to be the real challenge. So what does it mean for us today, sitting in the pews here? Well, as Christians, we're inherently optimistic. It's baked into our DNA from the very beginning. After all, God forgives us for our sins, both our sins of omission and of commission, and there's always the promise of everlasting life. But God is not going to get us out of this mess. We created it, and we will have to find a way through it. So I have a plea. When we're given time today to pray, and I think we may need a long time, take a moment to pray for the survival of our democracy. Through prayer and reflection, we each need to seek guidance for what we can do as individuals to preserve this grand experiment. Democracy can't survive without an engaged and informed constituent base, without leadership from people willing to listen, negotiate, and without civil discourse, and without a government infrastructure composed of qualified and committed civil servants. Now, for starters, while you're praying and reflecting today, I have five suggestions, but there's a lot of others. The first one is, listen to someone with whom you disagree. Listen to what they have to say and try to understand where they're coming from. Support candidates who believe in science and are guided by facts, not by ideology. Don't ignore intolerable and hateful speech. Don't accept it, but stand up to it. And commit to programs that develop and nurture civil literacy. And of course, vote. And with God's help, we may prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
After my sermon, there will be an opportunity for you, the members of this church and friends of this church, to talk back, to share your perceptions, perspectives, questions, and thoughts regarding what I've just shared. While serving as chaplain and member of the faculty to Wesleyan University, a colleague shared a story in which he was grading examinations turned into him by students in his large class. He glared from behind a stack of papers as the last student approached his desk. The student had gone well beyond the time limit the professor had allowed to complete the examination. Ignoring the teacher's obvious intent to reject his paper, the student asks, "Do you know who I am?" "No," the professor replied. "This is a large class, and unfortunately, I was unable to learn the names of every student." "Why does it matter to you?" To which the student said, "It doesn't." And he stuffed his paper in the middle of the stack and hurried away. Now, truly, there are many circumstances in which we don't mind being one of unknown many faces in the crowd, especially in this day and age where information technology has so intruded much of our personal and private affairs that we wonder if there's any room left for anonymity. Of equal, if not greater, importance is the fact that no matter how much under the radar we wish to be, your life matters. You are part of an interlocking network that includes family, friends, acquaintances within your job, church, and social interactions of every dimension of your life, where your slightest gesture, your slightest expression, your slightest opinion have consequences in the lives of others. Whether you know it, whether you like it, your life matters. Now, this is the fundamental premise of the Christian church, whose God, we believe, connects intimately with each of us, who searches diligently for each individual as a shepherd searches for a stray lamb, or as one who searches for a coin of great value. We believe that every person is created in the image of God and is an embodiment of God's Spirit
and therefore equally deserving with everyone else of the dignity and respect as a child of God. We hold these truths to be self-evident, said Thomas Jefferson, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now there's the rub. The colleagues to which Jefferson drafted what was to become the Declaration of Independence were not of the same mind when it came to the definition of what constituted a man. For many Southerners and some Northerners held enslaved African Americans. And at that time, laws in many parts of the colony defined them as less than human beings. And obviously, these words did not apply at all to women of any race. It would take nearly two centuries beyond this Declaration of Independence for America to come to some semblance of equality among its members. And still, we struggle. So we are not surprised to hear the story from Luke's gospel, where a widow, realizing she had nothing more to lose, relentlessly harassed the leader of her community until he could tolerate her presence no longer and relented to her demands for justice. But what justice did a Jewish woman, let alone a widow, in first century Judea have? Women had few rights outside domestic responsibilities relegated to them as wife and mother, preferably to male children. She could marry as young as 12 years of age and was always regarded as the property of either her father or husband. A woman without a husband, either by divorce or death, was the object of ridicule or pity, prompting the Talmudic prayer of thanksgiving that God has not made me a woman. Now, we don't know if the widow of Jesus' parable was wealthy or poor, but she was certainly well connected enough to inflict this otherwise callous judge with an endless barrage of complaints until he gave in to her wishes. The story is intended as a stark contrast to the compassion of God, who considers the needs of those others see as the least among them, and the struggle between God's vision of humanity and ours continues. Just 60 years ago, our nation and much of our world were perceived, defined, directed by predominantly white male Protestant perspectives. Everybody loved Ike. Billy Graham was the moral compass of the world, and Ozzie and Harriet represented the model family. And then all hell broke loose. As Bob Dylan says, the times they are a-changin'. Like the student confronting his teacher, the world's people since then, like the student confronting his teacher, the oppressed communities of the world have been asking the power brokers, do you know who I am? But unlike the nameless student who hurried away, they, like the widow, are staying around and declaring, my life matters. No longer are they taking the test, but testing the tester. And the very standards by which the test has been given that favors one race, a class, one culture, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation over others, and that imposes that system of preference in such a way that its military, criminal justice system, entrepreneurial systems, and political hegemony will keep those in the majority away from, apart from, barricaded from those they fear. However, a new majority is emerging, one that is not dominated by one race or gender, but more inclusive and integrative. But still, because it is different from the conventions to which many are accustomed, there is cause on their part for fear, for alarm, and for resistance to what they see as a threat to their system of values. It is understandable. It happens with any one of us who confronts change. They are circling the wagons for a last ditch and seemingly apocalyptic confrontation for the heart and soul of humanity, dividing the world between us and them, between good and evil. In this election year, I wonder if we are a nation approaching a clash of competing values, competing visions, competing objectives based on race, class, and culture that are irreconcilable. In response to this question, I'm inspired by the lives of Ruby Sales and Jonathan Daniels. You see, Sales is an African-American Southern social activist who at age 17 participated in efforts to desegregate white-only establishment in the early 60s. She was joined by Daniels, a young, white, New England, Harvard-educated Episcopal seminarian. He was the poster child of everything good about the status quo. But unlike much of the status quo that he represented, which separated his people from those Sales lived among, unlike much of the status quo, Daniel, through the experience of this intimate friendship he had with Sales, learned quickly what she already knew, that her life mattered. It mattered so much to him that when her life was threatened by a shotgun-wielding segregationist, he pushed her out of the way and took the bullet meant for her and died instantly. Their friendship and his sacrifice softened the resistance of two already divided racial communities toward each other and intensified the struggle against desegregation in the South. Brothers and sisters, God meets us most visibly in that demilitarized zone between circled wagons and the oncoming forces of change. And the church is called to occupy that space of meeting, reconciliation, and hope. Are we prepared to do this? How might we do this?